So, Steve, silly season is at an end. It's a new parliamentary session that starts next week. We are reconvening after our summer holiday. Our task cam mic is sat on a biography of Roy Jenkins, John Campbell's excellent biography, actually, of Roy Jenkins, which feels quite appropriate as we go into the business end of the Brexit, no deal, Armageddon that awaits us. I think we'll have to do a lot of thinking about Roy Jenkins in the months and years ahead.
That's not a phrase I thought I'd ever hear in my life.
And I spent 3 hours writing and researching the episodes we're going to record today, and then Boris Johnson plunged the UK into a constitutional crisis by proroguing Parliament. So truly, existential despair really doesn't get better than this. We're going to look back on what happened over silly season, because none of the main parties cover themselves in glory, and we're going to talk about it in a special episode that we're going to call How Not to Do Politics. Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast that refuses to pick its fantasy prime minister. My name's Corey Hazelhurst, and my partner in propaganda, Steve Haynes.
Hey, Corey.
Right, let's go into the party, Steve. Let's start with the Conservatives, who are in government, after all. Boris Johnson is our new prime minister. I can't believe I've said that. He's just returned from the G7, where he saved the Amazon rainforest. He's been in office now just over a month, and he has another 80-odd days to beat George Canning, who's the shortest ever serving prime minister, because he served, as you know, for 119 days.
Yeah, that's obviously a fact that was on, you know, the tip of my tongue. I just didn't get a chance to you know, to interrupt you with it.
Now, I know that really we should be talking about the constitutional crisis that we're now in, but can I give you my fun fact about George Canning?
If you must.
George Canning fought a duel and injured Lord Castlereagh, the old foreign secretary in the 19th century. You know, the Lord Byron poem?
Yes.
You know, yeah. Grave of Castlereagh, here's day in the piss. Yes. That meant, because he injured Castlereagh in his duel, he wasn't made foreign secretary. He was passed over, someone else got the post. And then he refused to serve in a cabinet with Castlereagh for years, having to wait until Castlereagh died before he could get a cabinet position. Oh, there's going to be a lot of Tory infighting over the next few months, but I don't think we'll see any actual dueling.
Primarily only because I feel like it's illegal these days. It would not shock me to discover that if he could get away with it, that Philip Davies would definitely challenge Dominic Grieve to a pistol duel.
Now, Peter Bone, I think, is most likely to challenge people to a duel.
What do you think, listeners? Which Conservative Party MP do you think is most likely to challenge one of their other colleagues to a duel, be it pistol or sword?
This is why we have to get a Patreon account set up, because obviously for that would be a Patreon subscribers only.
Yeah, obviously, the poll of polls.
DuelyMP.co.uk. I can see it now. It almost puts the Labour Party rivalries into the shade, certainly until the next shadow cabinet reshuffle. Anyway, right, the Conservatives, one thing they're not doing very well is going full-on populist route. So the Conservatives' official Twitter account have a big photo of the six politicians from the six different parties who met to try and stop no deals. And they've said that these six politicians are plotting to cancel the votes of 17.4 million people. That's quite bad, isn't it?
I mean, it is. But like, at the end of the day, you can also say that they're representing the other half of the other near 50% of the people who voted in the opposite direction.
Yes, but there's a way to do that without being populist and somehow saying that these are shadowy elites trying to cancel your vote, isn't there?
Yeah, there absolutely is. Right. For the Tories in particular, they've effectively just ended up in a corner with no manoeuvrability as to where they can go. Theresa May set out her red lines. Freedom of movement must end, we will be outside the customs union, all of that sort of stuff. Which then basically left very little wriggle room in terms of how you can actually position a Brexit policy. That in turn means that given Theresa May refused to make any changes and just kept on banging the same old rhetoric time and time again, she started playing up the no deal is better than a bad deal rhetoric. The Tories have just managed to corner themselves where the only Brexit that is acceptable to their members, and the only Brexit that is going to be acceptable to an awful lot of their voters as well, is what they're terming a clean Brexit, or largely speaking, a no-deal Brexit at this point.
I completely agree and it's something we'll talk about quite a bit in this episode, and no doubt from here until Christmas, that...
Surely you mean the end of time.
on Europe for the next 15 years. That the reason why the Conservatives are embarking on the course they're doing is because they think it'll be electorally expedient. Just as you can see there's an electoral reason for Labour to go more Remainy, there's a reason for Tories to go more Leavey. However, I'm not sure, and this leads us on to the second thing that we're going to talk about, the Tories at the moment seem also quite bent on, as you say, going for a no-deal Brexit, which the government's own analysis shows will probably lead to shortages of food and medicine.
Yeah, which leads you into that kind of question of, you know, to what extent is the government actually wanting to go for a no-deal Brexit, or are they literally just desperately trying to find some kind of Trump card that will allow them to get some kind of deal through Parliament? Here's the thing. If all the pomp, the sound and the fury about a no-deal Brexit is enough to win over an awful lot of, in effect, Brexit Party-supporting voters, to bring them back into the Conservative fold, and based on what we're seeing in the polls, that looks like it is the case to at least some degree. If that's just enough, and then Johnson can present something as some change to Theresa May's deal as some form of victory, then maybe, just maybe, that's their actual battle plan here, and they're just trying to get something through with a minor concession from the EU that they can trumpet. If someone can get away with that, it is Boris Johnson. He's got the Brexiteer credentials.
That's definitely what they're trying to do. The appointment of Cummings in number 10, as we've said, well, see, I was sceptical, I think, last time I recorded as to whether or not an autumn election was happening. Seems like it's almost nailed on. Equally, as I've said on previous podcasts, the appointment of people like David Frost as the PM's Brexit Sherpa, who's going around European capitals at the moment, and the appointment of people like Michael Gove and Geoffrey Cox to the Alliance of Magicians, which is the no-deal Brexit planning group. These are people who want a deal. In case you weren't looking at the news yesterday, what has happened is that Boris Johnson is going to ask the Queen essentially to prorogue Parliament, to cancel Parliament between about early mid-September and October the 14th.
Under the guise of basically having a Queen's speech on October the 14th or something like that. Stuff like that. Which is actually a pretty standard constitutional practice. You have a Queen's speech and Parliament gets prorogued.
Yes, if you are disingenuous about it, yes, it's standard.
My point is not necessarily that it's constitutionally a good thing or anything like that. My point is that it's not illegal, which is, I think, is also what's brought about an awful lot of the kind of like the flapping from people today, is that they assumed that a proroguing of Parliament would be some kind of massive illegal act, rather than it actually being a part of the uncodified British constitution.
Well, I mean, we can you know, dance around it if you like and say technically the prorogation is just resting in the account. But let's face it, people know what's going on here. I've kind of had a sick, worried feeling of dread for probably the last 3 years. And the reason it hasn't necessarily increased today is because as Johnson's administration seems bent on getting an election, but Johnson doesn't want to necessarily call an election himself. Essentially, trying to get Parliament to bring down the government, I think, call his bluff, so he has to call an election for him. So either you get into a situation where either there's a successful vote of no confidence in Johnson's government, and if a government cannot be found in 2 weeks, doesn't look like it will be, given how...
Given the discussions that I've had and the back and forth that we've seen over the past couple of weeks.
So it doesn't look like an alternative government can be formed. Sorry, Ken Clark. I mean, the alternative is that Johnson, as you say, tries to get some sort of concessions, which maybe we can talk about on another exciting technical Brexit podcast, tries to bring that back to Parliament. That's voted down, and then Johnson goes for an election on a Parliament have blocked my deal, this is the deal I want, I need a majority for this deal. The EU would probably grant an extension for such an election, probably, maybe. So I can see what he's trying to do. The only problem, of course, is that this is it leads us into the third thing they're doing wrong, which is they're making promises they can't keep. I mean, we've excoriated May enough for saying that no deal is better than the bad deal and normalising the no deal rhetoric. Well, the government is now literally spending taxpayers' money trying to promote a no deal Brexit. And a lot of people like Johnson, like Gove, who have been in cabinet, know how bad no deal will be, are essentially paying lip service to the fact that they have to go through the motions of going to no deal, essentially just to make a rhetorical point. Meanwhile, Nigel Farage is on the television saying, well, the only possible Brexit is a clean Brexit. So, you know, whatever Brexit policy the Tories have, Farage will outflank him from the insane angle. And let's face it, if Johnson's plan goes well, and we do leave with a Brexit deal, well, Farage's won both ways, hasn't he? He's both got Brexit and the betrayal narrative of Brexit that he can flog for £100 a month subscription to the Brexit Club.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think really this is kind of, for the Tories at least, we're meant to be talking about kind of like politics that isn't being done well and what's not good politics. But for the Tories, at least in this kind of situation, there's almost basically what's good politics across the immediate short term versus what's good politics for the medium to long term are very different. And as such, that's where we're kind of seeing them actually being in a kind of like playing politics poorly. It's on that medium to long term angle, because short term, separate whether or not you think it's a good thing, if Brexit's a good thing, separate your opinion on prorogation from the perspective of the government. Short term, this is actually a pretty strong move. They've managed to identify a way to prorogue Parliament, which has basis in you know, the constitution. They've managed to make it so that they are appearing to be very, very tough on the EU and actually preparing for all of these things by actually spending money. Yes, it probably is all a little bit of a bluff, and they don't want a no deal Brexit, but they're showing all of the things that they need to show that to make it look like they're serious about it, which is good on the short term. And maybe gets them into the situation that they want, which is a general election that they're not responsible for calling. But long term, as you say, almost doesn't matter what they do. You know, Boris Johnson could perform an absolute miracle, and Nigel Farage would still be able to come at them from the right on some angle of it, simply because it's not no deal Brexit, and that's what they promised. Because at the moment, for an awful lot of the Brexiteering right, the symbology of no deal is actually more important than actually leaving the EU in any other way.
I have a number of issues about that. I mean, one of them is that, and you've consciously done it, you've left morality out of the picture. Yep. All entirely.
Yeah, because that's what they're doing, I feel.
Roy Jenkins is staring at me, and I can't help but feel that, you know, politics is meant to be you're meant to govern in a noble way for people, rather than just say, well, I can play petty politics at Westminster and therefore food shortages are fine.
Yes, but Boris Johnson is our Prime Minister, so that's...
But this is the point, like, we should still be able to attack the government from the essence of morality. Like, we can't just excuse...
Oh, yeah, we can...
We can't just excuse morality just because it's purely electoral politics.
We can absolutely attack the government for doing that, attacking them on a you know, an immoral basis or whatever we want to call it. Just don't expect that to actually win anybody over from the other side.
No, but the other thing I think is that it is, as you say, the difference between strategy and tactics. And Boris Johnson has the problem of being Boris Johnson, of being the Prime Minister of a party with a majority of one, with a parliamentary party stuffed full of people who think he's manifestly unsuited for the role. That includes people who backed him in his leadership campaign. So part of his deception is partly to almost convince his parliamentary party that he's also a half-decent prime minister. Well, which doing quite well with the media so far, because somehow he's getting plaudits from the media for being more entertaining than Theresa May. It's almost like, well, Theresa May was contemptuous of parliament in a really kind of cack-handed, incompetent way, whereas at least Johnson kind of treats them with contempt and a certain amount of bravado.
It's the standard thing with Donald Trump in America. Like, Boris Johnson is always good for some form of quote, some form of headlines, just because partially it is just the way he is, but it's also the image he plays up to and tries to present of himself as this bumbling, you know, intellectual. It's different. It's unique in terms of politicians in the UK. There's nobody else who can really do that and get away with it as well. There are lots of other MPs you could imagine maybe trying it. Johnson has got the charisma to be able to pull it off, which means the media are gonna fall for it hook, line and sinker, because we live in an age where they desperately need content to feed the 24-hour news cycle.
We should leave talk about the Conservatives for now, but essentially, it's very bad. Johnson's trying to call the EU's bluff and Parliament's bluff. I don't think the EU will blink necessarily, and it depends where the Parliament blinks as well, which we should get on to.
Yeah.
So next is the Labour Party, who we've had a better summer than last year, because last year we didn't really have a summer grid, because our summer was taken up with anti-Semitism. People, issues of allegations of anti-Semitism. People then denying there was anti-Semitism in the Labour Party using anti-Semitic tropes. It was a fun summer, listeners. You had to be there. This summer, we did have a summer grid which came out. And we announced wonderful policies such as, I think, banning grouse shooting, I think is one of them. Keeping monkeys as pets. That's banned now under a Labour government.
I wasn't even aware that you were allowed to.
Not anymore, Steve. Not in this brave new world we're in. Now, in defence of this, Labour officials have said that a big viral point in the 2017 election were the fact that the Tories and their manifesto had bringing back fox hunting, that kind of stuff.
Mm.
And therefore, these are policies which play really well on the doorstep. Now, I'm saying maybe the counter-argument to that is that I think a lot of people at the moment see Labour as being absent on the big issue of the day, which certainly in Birmingham isn't necessarily grouse shooting. It's Brexit. And I can't think of a better metaphor for Labour seeming to be absent on the issues of the day but worrying instead about its policy agenda than a 50-point animal plan coming out in a Brexit-dominated summer recess.
You can kind of see the logic where they're coming from in the notion of, oh yeah, the Tories wanting to bring back fox hunting, that did really, really well as part of the the social media play in the last general election. Let's see if we can recreate that in some capacity. Two massive problems with that strategy. One is that you're ignoring the big issue of the day, which is Brexit. And the other one, and I may go off on a bit of a tangent on this one, the reason people cared so much about fox hunting is that fox hunting is ridiculously emblematic of, like, the class divide in the UK. Grouse shooting is almost certainly something that is only done by richer people, but it's not as symbolic as fox hunting was. There's not as much pageantry. There's not as much ridiculous costumes and a big kind of scene that can be done. Fox hunting, dozens of horses, people dressed in red, dozens of dogs, you know, running, lots of noise, lots of commotion. Grouse shooting's two people in their garden.
I think generally they go out into the woods and shoot the grouse.
But you know what I mean.
How gardens have these people got, Steve?
Well, I do know somebody, one of my old teachers, who literally, for their summers, would go to see their mate, and they would do grouse shooting in their garden.
Some of us grew up in gritty northern comps, Steve. Didn't go to grammar schools like Shenley Court.
I was about to say, some of us grew up in Wheelie freaking Castle.
That's an obscure Birmingham reference. We haven't had one of those for a while.
Yeah. The basis of this strategy,
right,
anyway, is crap. But the Brexit thing is the big one, because you're not talking about what actually people are going to be concerned with. Or rather, essentially, what they're trying to do is build up enthusiasm amongst their target voters that Labour are a good thing and get them excited about a Labour government. The problem is, all of that stuff is so, it's not even secondary, I think that's tertiary kind of policy things which aren't going to necessarily affect people's decisions in the next general election. Whilst we have an ongoing constitutional crisis, whilst we have Brexit, maybe it's been resolved, maybe it hasn't, and even if it has been resolved, we've still got 15 years worth of discussions off the back of it. You know, it's just completely arse backwards as a strategy.
Corbyn gave a speech over the summer, which was a fairly decent speech setting out a kind of putative election campaign strategy, which the policies we should talk about more in some detail, just not on this podcast. Again, they're fine policies. But of course, the takeaway from the press conference afterwards was his less than equivocal answers about Brexit. You can't go into an election and ignore the main question on the exam paper. What I'm hearing mainly from your takeaway about grouse shooting is that we should legislate that you can only shoot grouse while on horses, wearing red and wearing a silly hat, and then ban it.
Yes.
Okay.
After a couple of hundred years of, you know, it being a symbol
of the
aristocracy.
It's a third term issue, yeah. Okay. Right, let's just have a think about the Lib Dems. That, I think, gives us more of a chance then to talk about the problems of government of national unity conversation.
Yeah, they both screwed up on this level, I feel.
Well, I think because both misunderstand the other and both mischaracterise the other, which I think isn't very helpful. I think the problem in terms of how the Dems have tried not to do politics is, and it's that difference between strategy and tactics again. As I've said in previous episodes, I think they've identified the strategy quite well in that they need to win over votes in Tory Lib Dem marginals. And therefore, they need an answer for, well, if we vote for you, we're just going to get Corbyn, aren't we? And so that's why they're going very hard on Corbyn. And that has led to a little bit of an incoherent line So, again, I was trying to follow this on holiday in France, but the line in terms of government and national unity seemed to be, no, we're not going to do this at all, it's not going to work, people won't agree to it, and certainly not with Corbyn, to, okay, maybe Ken Clark, to, yes, okay, we'll meet and talk about it, to Jeremy Corbyn's a terrible Brexiter, we can't do this. It just seemed a little bit muddled. I don't know if that's just because Joe Swinson's a new leader, maybe with a new comms team or what have you.
I think what you've kind of outlined there is interesting in that it shows that the communication strategy that they had around this probably has failed, in that it's you as somebody who actually does follow all this stuff, and even when you're on holiday, it was still kind of following it to a degree. You were kind of looking at it and kind of going, what are they trying to say here? So if you're seeing that, then what's the average person going to see? Probably nothing at all. They're just going to see that headline moment, which is basically all I picked up with, just because of how busy I've been with work and things over the past few weeks. That headline moment of Joe Swinson refuses to back Jeremy Corbyn as Prime Minister. Cool. From that kind of strategic viewpoint, absolutely correct thing to do if it, you know, helps win them more seats in the next general election. The issue is, again, on the bigger, wider point of Brexit and preventing it and stopping a no deal, all of that sort of stuff, it immediately undermines the attempt to do that. In my opinion, when it comes to the government of national unity stuff, both Labour and the Lib Dems have both got a significant amount to blame for this falling through. I think Jo Swinson was correct, largely speaking, when she said Jeremy Corbyn could not actually command enough of the House to actually do that. Not only would he need to win over all of his MPs to actually back him as Prime Minister, which is separate to bringing down the government. That I could easily see happening, but him being backed as Prime Minister, he's got to win over all of his MPs, and let's be honest, there are probably a couple that almost certainly wouldn't. Kate Hoey, for instance. Got to win over some Tory MPs. And yes, they're the more left-wing ones. Yes, they're the more Remain-y ones. Yes, it's Dominic Grieve and all of that sort of stuff. But they're still not going to really like him. Like, the vast majority of them have not done a Guto Bebb and come out and said, no, Jeremy Corbyn is the lesser of two evils when it compared to a hard deal Brexit. Most of them still don't like him. Joe Swinson was correct on that level, that he was probably very unlikely to actually win over the House. To a degree, what she said, how about King Clark? I believe they also suggested maybe Harriet Harman as an alternative. Kind of the correct call to make, because King Clark, the left's favourite Tory, basically, and Harriet Harman,
the right's favourite Labour. I know, and that fails down. Actually.
Yeah. Harriet Harman, well respected within Labour. A serious player, a heavy hitter, somebody that would look credible in the position of Prime Minister. Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour leadership then at this point basically went, oh, you're trying to get Jeremy to stand down as Labour leader. Like, no, we can't have that, I can't support that. And that wasn't what was actually said. What was said that they wouldn't support Jeremy Corbyn becoming Prime Minister. You could have had Harriet Harman come in, Jeremy Corbyn still as Labour leader. And this is not an unprecedented thing in British history, to have a leader of the party who is not the Prime Minister.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually relatively common.
Well, I don't know if it's that. Well, the famous example is Chamberlain was still leader of the Tory Party in 1940, and Churchill became Prime Minister.
Yeah, and for some reason, I think Lloyd George might have had a little overlap a bit.
Well, they did party politics very differently in those days.
Yeah. That's very true. You can have that situation. It's not unheard of. So at which point, Jeremy Corbyn is still Labour Party leader. He looks really mature and like an adult statesman by basically saying, I am prepared to step back from my own personal ambitions for the good of the country. We get this through. We have, you know, maybe it's a year-long thing to get a referendum through and then an election, whatever that looks like. And then Jeremy Corbyn potentially goes into it. One, maybe having held one of the great offices of state, maybe, and also looking very mature and looking like an actual statesman by making a sensible choice. But by not doing that and not focusing on that path was available, Jeremy Corbyn and his leadership team just shut everything down. It was our way or the highway. And that then just causes the Lib Dems to respond in kind by basically just upping their rhetoric on it as well, which in turn annoys the Labour Party and Labour MPs, which in turn makes everything much less likely to happen.
There's problems with both sides' approaches, and I think it's partly because of the stories each section of the party tells itself on Europe. and therefore the attitude they have to it. So with Lib Dems in Europe, it's very much a, we are the pro-Europeans, we are the principled ones, we were here before everyone else. A lot of that is true. I disagree with some of it. And I think from that point of view, they see Corbyn as not really being a proper Remain campaigner. They see the Labour Party as not being really a proper Remain party. They see it all over the place. And is essentially now trying to, having most of the MPs trigger voting to trigger Article 50, essentially coming to the party later to try and take down the government and try and be the good guys. And I think there's a little bit of resentment at that. In terms of a lot of the Corbynite Labour left, I think a lot of them see Europe as being an issue that Jeremy Corbyn's opponents have used to attack him. Bantasaurus Rex did so in the second leadership campaign. His whole thing was, I'm Corbyn, but pro-European. A lot of the people's vote, Labour MPs, like people like Chuka Umunna, people like Wes Streeting, happened to be the ones who were also most critical of Jeremy Corbyn. And Tom Watson now, I think that kind of, Tom Watson I think is seen as factionalising the dispute of Labour over Europe again. And I think attacks from the Lib Dems are seen in that light. And so I think you've got a situation where not only do Labour, I think, lots of Labour people misrepresent the Lib Dems. They're, as we've said, very angry still about the role of the coalition, the role in austerity. I think Lib Dems also misrepresent the views of Labour on Europe a little bit, and I think don't quite understand where a lot of the Labour Party is coming from. And certainly I don't think understand the political incentives of Labour MPs. Like, there is no way, with trigger ballots coming up in a lot of seats, that Labour MPs can vote for Harriet Harman or Ken Clarke as Prime Minister rather than Corbyn first. Yeah. It comes down, I think with the Lib Dems on this, it probably comes down to a principle of dibs, which I think is in our constitution. Like, you have the vote of no confidence.
Right next to the article on proroguing Parliament.
Yeah, I think it's more like, look, dibs is perfectly legal.
but it isn't moral, Corey.
The Fixed Term Parliaments Act says if there's a vote of no confidence, there's 2 weeks to find an alternative government. So Corbyn has first dibs as leader of the opposition. Now, presumably, if you're Swinson, you say, well, we'll only do that in these conditions, which I'm guessing would be referendum before a general, no major manifesto, that kind of stuff. You have then, I think the issue is maybe there's a lot of people who don't want to legitimise Corbyn as Prime Minister because I think once you've got the office, you could become more Prime Ministerial.
Yeah, there's a scene from one of the late, must have been probably actually the last season of The West Wing, given it's Jimmy Smith's character.
Spoilers!
Spoiler alert, if you've not seen every single
episode.
Alan
Alda becomes
Santos is preparing for like a primary debate or the presidential debate. And he's got somebody who's helping him kind of like look and sound presidential. And the entire point they basically make on that is just be yourself, because when you hold the office, you immediately become presidential. Does not necessarily work if your name's Donald Trump, but the general point actually does stand in that the minute you hold a position, people are more likely to say of course you hold the qualities of to have that position, because they can see it.
But even with Trump, people did that, didn't they?
Yeah,
like,
they tried.
The day when Trump stood there and said he would like to nuke the hurricane was the day he finally became president. But the serious strikes and stuff, wasn't there? There were lots of people looking for signs that he was presidential. I think there's a certain fear that somehow making Corbyn Prime Minister would legitimate him in that way.
Yes, and I think that probably is actually accurate as well. You know, whether or not that's a good or a bad thing. But
I wonder if maybe, if I was the Lib Dems, I would try and say, yeah, look, go ahead and try.
Yeah.
Like, and that's the point is, I wouldn't necessarily, and it's hard because everything's getting very tribal at the moment, and Labour people have thrown a lot of mud at the Lib Dems. Some of it less justified than others, and Lib Dems have had a lot of money in the Labour Party, and everyone's going up for next, and everyone's very, very unhappy.
Yeah.
But I think if I was the Lib Dems, I would just say, just
try.
Because, as you say, it's very unlikely that I don't think Corbyn does have enough. Now, at which point you say, well, let's try and do something else then.
Yeah, we've got 2 weeks to get this sorted after the vote of no confidence. Yeah. You've had your first bite at the cake. Let's talk about Harriet Harman and Ken Clarke.
And especially because a lot of Corbyn supporters and people in the Labour Party see Europe as being a distraction. You can imagine the reaction, can't you? This is a coup. I can see that happening. Like, he's the democratically elected leader of the Labour Party. He got 12 million votes in the last election. 500,000 members voted for him. And now you're stopping him from being Prime Minister because you want someone who won't frighten the horses. But equally, I think a lot of Labour people are misunderstanding that a lot of what the Lib Dems are doing is just posturing. And that's kind of fine. Because as someone who, he says in front of a biography of Roy Jenkins, would quite like to see a progressive alliance, the kind of anti-Tory, at least in terms of anti-Tory tactical voting that worked so well for us in 2001 and 1987, to stop a Tory government, you need a revival of the Lib Dems in the South West. And you need those people who voted Lib Dem to vote Labour and not vote Lib Dem as a protest on Labour's policy in Europe. And the problem, I think, is that Labour and Lib Dems have drifted so far since then. And that's partly because, I think, of New Labour's authoritarianism. It's partly because of the Orange Booker wing in the Lib Dems. Remember the Orange Bookers? It's partly...
That was one of the Vince Cable's many faces.
But it's partly, I think, that kind of shift economically towards the Tories. I think it's also then austerity. To kind of progress in the future, we need to kind of be aligned again. But you've got a lot of people in the party suspicious of Lib Dems, but also aren't really interested in working with other parties. Mm-hmm. And this is a problem as well. I mean, Grace Blakely today was tweeting, who's a bit of a Corbyn outrider on economics, little bit Lexity, and was tweeting something to the effect of, it'll be really easy for the Tories to present Labour as the establishment, given we're working with other parties to try and stop a no-deal Brexit.
That doesn't matter. Like, the people who are going to not vote for you because you're the establishment are probably never going to vote for you anyway, given you're a left-winger.
And it's something we've said a lot already. The thing that unites Labour First people with the Corbynite left is Labour First don't want to work with other parties, they just want Labour, because they're tribalist bastards. And the Labour left don't want to work with other parties because they want a proper socialist party, and the Lib Dems are bourgeois. Sorry, Mark, that's their opinion, not mine. I think you're lovely. So what opposition parties decided to do was to not put in a vote of no confidence straight away. They went instead to try and pass legislation first. So the Cooper-Letwin bill was ready to go. That has been a bit gazooked, hasn't it, by the proroguing parliament bit, which you imagine is classic Cummings, as Mark Wallace says, like, always do what your enemy doesn't want to do. It's the mark of someone who's read too much military history.
The prorogation, as you know, is problematic, yes, but in terms of like the actual kind of physical impact on the actual process, it's actually not necessarily that great, because when you actually look at it, we come back from recess, from the summer recess for a couple of weeks, and then we get another recess for the party conferences. Then we come back for a little bit, and then I think that's when the prorogation happens. But I think, practically speaking, all that tends to get that's being lost is about 3 days. At least that's what some of the analysis that I've seen has suggested. So yeah, not helpful at all, but not catastrophic from the perspective of can we stop Brexit, or can we stop a no-deal Brexit? We've seen previously anti-Brexit bills get voted on, passed, and in both houses in a day. If there's the political will to make that happen, it can happen. Yeah.
And I think prorogation speeds that up.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Dominic Grieve, a bit like Labour, has been playing a choose-your-own-adventure Brexit line. Well, I don't really want to bring down the government, but if I'm forced to, I will. And he's been accelerated to kind of DEFCON Grieve, hasn't he?
Yeah.
Where it's like, well, I...
Make your choice, mate.
I wouldn't be surprised if we do see a vote of no confidence next week.
Wouldn't shock me. God knows what happens, but...
Well, indeed. And we'll be there to talk about it. We have an episode out on Sunday. It looks like, given that we've talked for a very, very long time, it'll probably be me and Steve arguing about what a coup means. and how to label things. In the meantime, our website is notenoughchampagne.com. Our Facebook page is facebook.com/notenoughchampagne. Our Twitter page is @nochampagnepod. My Twitter handle is @paperbackwriter.
Mine's @acousticradical.
James Cram designed our logo, and Dave Tepp is responsible for our theme tune, Plucky Good Times. Happy plotting.